All right. Let's get fired up here.
Maximum freedom. Read.
Stay on target.
Maximum freedom.
Stay on target.
Maximum freedom. Read Rothbard.
Hello and welcome to the next episode of the Read Rothbard podcast. This is our first non-special of 2017. With me, as always, is Robert. And how you doing, Robert? We're here to talk
What's
about
up,
a movie.
2017?
We're here to talk about a movie, Hell or High Water. That's what we do on this show.
Oh, we're still doing that? Okay. Cool.
Yeah, let's do that one. So what we do, people who may or may not be familiar with us, is we take a movie, we watch it, we look for any libertarian or Austrian economic type lesson or, I don't know, similarity that we can highlight in our retelling of said story, our little synopsis, and it gives us some points of reference for people who may not be familiar with these concepts. So that's what we do here on the Read Rothbard podcast.
And then we analyze the behaviors and actions of the characters from a non-aggression principle perspective. And like you said, hopefully that maybe provides some context and perspective for people to think about in a way they maybe not have before. Even though I think most people have a kind of a gut level, whether they support a particular action or not in the morality of a character. But we're giving it a very... We try to have from a concrete perspective.
Yes, and we also run readrothbard.com. There's books, lectures, articles, this podcast, and a bunch of other stuff there at readrothbard.com. And we also slang stuff. We try to push, say, Liberty Classroom or Amazon links, other ways of supporting the work that we do. So there's a bunch of links and banner ads and all that junk. So feel free to click on any of those. You can also get a free trial for readit4.me. 30 days free from us. Just find that link on our tip jar page, and you will get that for free.
Yeah, we are liberty whores. So if you like liberty, learn about it.
Yeah, Liberty Sluts was already taken.
So Daniel, you were talking to me about some sort of kidnapping, and I was just kind of like bullshitting back at you, and you said no, I actually said a thing.
Yeah, so that's another thing we do on the show is we talk about a little bit of newsworthy items. And so one of the newsworthy items, Robert was talking about the professor at a university who made a tweet about white genocide, and they said, oh, yeah, you know, that sort of reminds me of this other thing with there's this white kidnapping, and you said, oh, you mean so you can do anything you want to white people, and it's totally okay because they're the oppressors, and, you know, they'll just blow it off as if it's nothing. Well, it turns out that there is recent news out of Chicago where four black persons, people of color, I don't know what the proper thing to say right now is, kidnapped a mentally retarded, developmentally disabled white person for between 24 and 48 hours, tied him up, beat him up, yelled, fuck white people, fuck Trump, recorded this, Facebook live streamed it, and made him drink toilet water, and then the kids doing this, they were 18, so, you know, technically adults, and that's a point of contention on the Read Rothbard podcast, you know, like, when are you an adult or not, and it's kind of sliding scale, you know, but this was on CNN and other MSNBC type fake news situation reported on fake news, and they said, oh, they're just kids, you know, kids, they're just doing stupid shit, or oh, it's not a hate crime because it's black people, or things along those lines. Like, they're being it's conflated with the Black Lives Matter a little bit, and they're providing cover for it. When you know if it were four white people doing this to a black person, it would be all over the place, denounced as a hate crime. It would be like about how the United States and American culture is like inherently racist, and it's just a prime example. It'd be blamed on Trump. In fact, one of the news reports actually blamed this attack on Trump.
Trump was there?
I guess so. I mean, otherwise it's fake news, right? I mean, if he wasn't actually there, then they couldn't really correctly say that.
Well, I haven't seen this coverage, being out here in the wilderness. I don't have the TV. But I have seen clips in the past of things like you're talking about, with CNN basically being violence apologists when it's ever done by people of color. However, I just saw the headline right now as you're talking about it, and it says that hate crime charges have been filed for this exact thing you're talking about, and that the torturers could face up to 30 years in prison. So you've got the actual reality of, I guess, the cops actually doing a thing versus the mainstream lefty narrative that when black people or people of color do a thing, since they're oppressed, it's not actually racist, which is a thing in a lot of places because they equate racism with power. And if you don't have the power, and this is like this nebulous term, power, and if you don't have the power, then you cannot be racist. So since everybody puts like white men at the top of the power pyramid, why? They won't say. They'll point to like some, like, well, CEOs are white men and most politicians are white men. Therefore, every white man in the United States, and therefore society is slanted towards white men. When the reality is, nobody's trying to give a job to a white man. You got people with programs to give jobs to people of color, people with different ethnic backgrounds, different genders, whatever, to fill up their diversification quotas. But if there's a white man with a job, chances are he got there through merit, not standing issues of, what's that word? Can you give a job to your kid? Nepotism?
Yep.
Not standing issues like that, but if you see a white man in a position, generally speaking, he got there through merit, not because of some program to give white men jobs. So this idea that white men are somehow just have power and other people don't, always this nebulous term. We can never really quite define what power is, but just magically we have it in the same way that I have power over whether, I don't know, my light switches freeze or not. And that's a weird thing to say since you're not going to put that in the beginning of the show into this part. But anyway, we'll take it, Daniel.
Yeah, so it does seem to be this whole power thing, which is very nebulous, very sort of a made-up term, and it's sort of like a perpetual enemy, right? Like, there never needs to be any actual evidence of it. There just needs to be connotations or correlations to make it be this undefeatable enemy that needs to be fought forever and can justify any action. Because, mm-hmm. you know, what these kids did, and, you know, they're 18, so technically not kids, right? What these people did was they attacked this guy because he was white, tortured him because he was white, said, drink from the toilet, bitch, say fuck Trump, fuck white people, fuck white people. And then the Chicago police say it's not a hate crime. And it's not the only incident that has been occurring since the election and even before where there were, you know, provocateur agents attending Trump rallies trying to provoke fights with people just so that it could be then twisted in that Trump supporters are violent. And it just goes along with the very tactics that the left like to use, which is, you know, pretty much any means necessary to push their agenda, which I don't know what happened, man. I think that the left, we've talked about this before. I think in the past when we were more left-leaning, it truly was like, hey, we saw problems in the world and injustices and things like that, and we thought, well, you know, let's be compassionate and try to figure these things out, fix them if we can, do what we can to make things better. And now it seems like they're all about just controlling everybody.
Yeah.
And maybe that was their agenda all along.
Well, it's definitely that social Marxism where you're the victim and you're like in the victim class and it's always really nebulous and they play to emotions and never a whole lot of logic or hard evidence. But yeah, we were, I want to say like the compassionate left, like the socially progressive, these words like are all meaningless now to me, but like, you know, you didn't want the government in your bedroom. You didn't like racism. And who does? But you thought that maybe there were supposed to be quotas. I don't remember back in the day. Do you remember if you were for affirmative action? I don't think I ever was. It's always seemed to be like a racist kind of a thing. Like you're going to give a job to a guy or put a guy in the position just because he's black or just because he's white, just because he happens to be a thing, not because he happens to be the best candidate. I don't think I was ever for that.
Yeah, I was not a fan of quotas. One of my friends who's now a firefighter would often ask me, like, all right, so if you got a baseball team, do you think that it's okay that they put a cap on the spending, you know, so that no one can just dominate like the Yankees and spend all the money on all the best players? And I was always like, well, you know, it's their team. They can do what they want.
Yeah.
I mean, it's sort of, yeah, that's a voluntary association. So like the NBA has a salary cap, and there's penalties that they pay to the league if they go over it. And it brings some level of parity, I suppose. But the Yankees don't win all the time. I mean, sure, they've won 27 out of 125 times, or however many times they've had a World Series now. So it's certainly swung in their favor, but they're also in the biggest market. They're generating the most revenue, what have you. So I forget where I was going with this, but we should probably get to talking about this movie before too long.
Sure. I would just add on to what you were kind of saying there, maybe, kind of, I think, is that it's a voluntary organization, and the Major League Baseball has an incentive to put on a competitive product. You don't want really one team just slaughtering the other team. People don't like, unless you're really a fan of that one team, you don't really like to go see a game where one team's just butchering the other one constantly and repeatedly. You want to see a competitive game, a close game, an exciting game. A blowout's not exciting for anybody except the most diehard fan base. So they have an incentive to basically ensure parity, or at least some level of it, across markets in order to provide the best possible product for the consumer. I don't see any problem with it. It's all voluntary.
Yeah.
But anyway, moving on, Hell or High Water. Let's see, this was a movie, came out recently. Let me pull up something. Why don't you talk for a few seconds while I pull it up?
Sure. And just to clarify, I don't believe that baseball does have a salary cap. I could be wrong, but I think it's the NBA that does, and so that it's kind of shown as being a difference between the two. I think the NFL also has a hard cap that does bring some level of parity, like teams from one year to the next year can often go from really good to really bad and vice versa, though the Patriots seem to be consistently good.
I'm pretty sure that the Major League Baseball does, because the Yankees would always play, I think it was like you'd pay double whatever you went over the cap back to the league, and the Yankees didn't care, and they were so flush with cash. They're like, well, we'll pay whatever fines. It doesn't matter. We want to win every year.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So this is an example where we are, or at least I am, definitely talking out of my ass. I used to care about sports a lot more and probably knew 10 years ago, like, what different structures around the different leagues and how they're, you know, how they're balanced or whatever in the past, but no longer. That's all gone now. Down the memory hole.
Oh, yeah. So on to this cowboy movie. It's 2016. It's a crime film slash drama film. This made it to many critics' top 10 lists. It's got a 7.8 on IMDb and 98% on Rotten Tomatoes. Let's see. It came out on August 12th. Directed by David McKenzie, and it made $31.1 million at the U.S. box office. And it's starring Chris Pine, Jeff Bridges, and Ben Foster. And before we get into what this movie is or who it's about or what happens, give me your general impressions about the movie. Did you like it, Daniel? Did you get to watch it all the way through? What happened?
Yeah, so my wife and I have tried to, after the kids are in bed, stay up and hang out, sometimes talk, sometimes watch movies, and she conflates the two, so she often pauses the movie a dozen or more times to tell me the latest thought in her head, or tell me she needs to pee, or eat, or put some lotion on, or put one of the kids back down, something like that. So it was an interrupted viewing, but I felt that the movie was well done. It was interesting. I liked the pacing of it. I don't know if it was like this most amazing movie, but it was entertaining. I'd probably watch it again at some point.
Yeah, I thought it was solid. I actually watched it with my old man back on the West Side. And he fell asleep a couple times. But he is a notorious movie sleeper. He will sleep through any movie, doesn't matter. So that's not really a thing against it. Although I will say that the pacing was fairly slow, especially towards the beginning. Even though it starts right off the bat with a bank robbery. So I will try and break down to the best of my memory, because apparently I do this better than Daniel, even though Daniel has seen this movie more recently. I did get to watch it mostly straight through, even though a friend came towards the end and kind of interrupted us a little bit, but it doesn't matter. Anyway, so we got Chris Pine and Ben Foster as two brothers who want to make a better life for their for his son, the Chris Pine guy. He has two sons, and he wants to make life better for them. They plan to rob a bunch of banks, a specific bank, like Texas. I forget the name of the bank, but it's like Texas Mutual or something like that, some kind of local Texas bank. And their plan is to rob them just of their till cash. No big bills, like marked bills, no with like ink packs or anything like that. Just till cash that isn't traceable for the most part. And they need enough to pay back a loan or like the mortgage on a ranch that the family owns, where it turns out that oil has been discovered. And the ranch is going to, as long as they maintain ownership of this place and don't default back to the bank, to the same bank they're robbing, it'll make like 50 grand a month in the amount of oil that they're going to be pumping out of this place. So their plan is to rob the bank, and they only owe like, I forget the exact amount, but it wasn't a whole lot. It was like $30,000 or $40,000. So they go around robbing each of these individual banks, and they can only get like, what is it, like 10, 15, 20,000 per robbery, something like that. So it starts off right away with a bank robbery, and they rob like three banks or so, four banks, one like on the spur of the moment, where the one brother knows about it, the other brother doesn't, just goes and robs the place. And their plan, so, is to rob the bank, pay them back with their own money, which they will then own the ranch, and then have the deed and all the ownership of the ranch be put into a trust for the boys, which the bank will then manage. So the bank's actually going to make more money, far more money, managing this trust for these two boys in fees than it would benefit them to maintain the trust as opposed to investigate necessarily the crime so much. So even though they would make more money if they owned the property, they're still coming out ahead of the deal in what was stolen from them. So that's kind of their scheme, that's kind of their plan, to kind of incentivize the bank to go along with the robbery. Ease. And it plays out. There's a Jeff Bridges plays the Texas Ranger, the main Texas Ranger. He's got a partner, I forget his partner's name, who leads the chase, basically. It's basically just him and his partner for these two guys. And he's kind of like this old school kind of cop. He's about to retire. And it all culminates in this last bank robbery where Bridges kind of picks out the next bank they're going to rob, kind of anticipates the next bank they're going to rob. And so there's a kind of a dramatic like chase scene. And it all takes place in Texas. So there's not only are these bank robbers robbing these banks, but there's also just like random guys around town who notice that there's a bank robbery going on. And they're like, well, shit, I'm armed. I don't like bank robberies. And so they're running out of this bank, and they just get opened to fire on by just random guys, not cops, just people, Good Samaritan type guys, who don't like robberies happening in their town. And the boys actually plan it all pretty well. They, whenever they get like do a robbery, they bury the car. So they're kind of smart about the whole thing. And the final robbery happens where there's a chase. They get out of town and they get away, and they've got like this assault rifle, and they scare away the Good Samaritan guys. And then they kind of split up, and then one brother kind of sacrifices himself so that the other brother, the Chris Pine guy, can get away. And at the end of the movie, Jeff Bridges has figured out who was really behind all the robberies. And knew, well, they knew that Ben Foster, the Pine's brother, obviously, was, because they end up killing him in a big kind of shootout. But Bridges knew that Pine was also involved. And so he shows up at the ranch, and they have kind of like the old, I know, you know, and you know, I know discussion at the end of it. And they decide that maybe they'll get together at some point and settle it the old-fashioned way. And that's the end of the movie. What struck me while watching it, and why I kind of suggested this movie to talk about, there were a couple issues. One, there were several instances of what I thought was kind of, you know, is this proper police behavior? And then the whole idea that you enter into a voluntary contract with a bank to loan some money. And then you're upset and you see it as kind of exploitative. But it's not like that the people who are upset with the banks don't have a decent point, because we are talking about fractional reserve banking, where the money is just invented out of whole cloth. They don't actually have that money in the reserve. They only need like 10% of the money in reserve, and they can loan out, you know, a dollar 9 different times to 9 different people. So if we're all just playing around with fake made-up money, well, let's just call it all good. What are you, you know, that's kind of the argument against it. But at the same time, you can't justify threatening and murdering people, because they do end up killing two people and threatening and robbing. So I don't see, in my estimation, I don't see the heroes in this movie, I don't see their behaviors as justified. I see it as understandable. I see that they have a point of view, a thing, a goal they want to achieve. I see they have a point of view of saying that the bank loan was illegitimate. I don't necessarily agree with that, but I can understand from a certain point of view. So it was kind of hard for me to root for them. But at the same time, I wasn't super happy with the Jeff Bridges cop character either, or any of the cops, or any cops in general. I was probably rooting most for just the random people getting robbed and saying there's one character at the very beginning, an old man who just happens to be in the bank doing a bank thing. When the two brothers come in with their ski masks on and they're robbing the place, and one of the brothers asks the old man if he's armed, and he's like, "Of course I'm armed. Why would I not be armed?" So they take his gun and I think he just like throws it, puts it on the table or something like that, puts it on the counter, which is a strange thing to do, but okay. And then the old man, as soon as the brothers take off, he opens fire on him. So that's kind of funny. And the whole culture of the Good Samaritans, just, yeah, I'm armed. I'm driving in a truck. I see something bad going down. I'm going to help out. I'm going to help defend people. So that's kind of my breakdown, but let's get into the weeds a little bit, Daniel. I want to hear what your thoughts were, what your general impressions were, and then we can talk about specific scenes.
Sure. So my watching of it, you know, it was Jeff Bridges, and I kept thinking, oh, you know, he's going to be Big Lebowski style in this, and he definitely is not. Like, he has aged quite a bit from those days, and he played being an old guy, I think, like a crusty old, about to retire Texas Ranger. That was the part, and he fit it pretty well. What you were saying about, you could sort of see where they were coming from. I felt like the whole film was sort of geared towards being anti-banking. Like, the very beginning, there's some graffiti on a building that they're panning across at the very opening, and it's like, I spent 3 tours in Iraq, where's the bailout for people like me?
Right.
So it's definitely a play up of the 2008 financial crisis that was a result of a lot of government dealings in propping up housing and making that sort of this no-lose proposition until everyone was wrong. And their mother, who owned the ranch, she got a reverse mortgage, is what they said. And I think it was related to her having some significant medical bills. The Chris Pine character was taking care of her as she was dying, and the other character, Ben Foster, was in prison and finally got out. So in a way, sure, she was taken advantage of, but she also, you know, voluntarily entered the agreement, like you were saying. But there's this huge backstop system put in place by the government and the Federal Reserve in the background that basically makes creating loans like this less risky for banks. So it entices them to make more and more loans that they otherwise would not do if they had to assume the risk themselves.
FDIC guarantees it.
Well, FDIC is guaranteed deposits, but many mortgages get sold off through Freddie or Fannie. And so the bank basically makes the loan and then sells it to Freddie or Fannie. And then you, the borrower, would then pay Freddie or Fannie. So it removes the risk from the bank making the loan. So that's going to loosen up the lending standards, as you can imagine. Like, oh, I can make this loan, no risk, and then I can just turn around and sell it at a guaranteed rate from government or the government-supported entity. And Tom Wood is great on this in his book called Meltdown. And so I'll put a link to that down below. You can buy that on Amazon. It's a good book. But he talks about all the government structures that are put in place to help support home lending and then also the servicing disadvantaged populations. I forget what that's called. You might recall it, but basically you're supposed to you have a quota for how many like disadvantaged populations can get loans, and so they have to go out of their way to like find people to accept these loans. So it's part of that myth of home ownership that was propagated by government.
Right. Yeah, there were several movies have come out, I think, detailing that, and where people would just be walking in and no money down, no job, no problem. Here's your loan. Here's your house loan. At the height of like the 2006-2007 home buying frenzy.
Yeah, I think those were called ninja loans. So no income, no job, and here you go. You get a loan. And the whole time, you know, prices for housing, of course, are increasing by double-digit percentages a year because of this, right? Because people are now flush with the capacity to make purchases on homes, so there's a lot more buyers out there than there otherwise would have been. And a lot of people are like flipping houses or just buying them to hold them for a few months to resell them at a higher price, or buying crappier, you know, run-down buildings, renovating them, some good, some bad, and then turning them around. So that's another form of flipping as well, I imagine. And as you can see, a lot of this would be malinvestment, right? This would be a lot of money being put into something that wouldn't otherwise have occurred, and people would have spent money on other things that are higher on their preference scale.
Sure.
That's pretty much all I have to say on that stuff. I'll also post a link down below to a Murray Rothbard lecture. It's about an hour and a half where he talks about banking and how loans come into being, and so that might be an interesting thing to listen to after listening to us, and you'll see a pretty distinct difference in the level of quality of the content between what we say and what Murray Rothbard had to say.
Do you regard, Daniel, fractional reserve banking as fraud, and do you think that in a free market such a thing would still exist?
I think that the current structure of fractional reserve banking, where people don't know that that's the case and it's not really presented to them in that way, then it is a fraud, because it goes back to like the goldsmiths who would store people's gold and then give you receipts, and then people would trade the receipts as if they were the gold, because you could always go and reimburse or turn them in, exchange them for the gold. And then they started figuring out that, well, not everyone comes in at the same time to get their gold, so we're safe in saying we have more gold than we actually do and putting out more and more receipts than what we actually have. And so that is fraudulent. I think that there is room for a type of banking like this where different banks would have different amounts that they hold onto, and I think that there would be, in a free market, this would be a competitive thing, right? Like, if you and I desire different levels of risk, I would go to a bank that has, you know, 100% reserves, whereas you might go to a bank that, oh, you know, they're going to have 50% reserves or 10% or whatever you're comfortable with. And I think that over time, there would be different servicings made available to people depending on the risk tolerance. And, you know, banks that weren't servicing people the way that they should be would go out of business, and the ones that succeeded would grow and be profitable.
I could see that. And I assume that the banks that carry a lower percentage of reserve would be able to offer higher rates of return due to the higher risk involved.
Yeah.
They could be able to take that extra money and reinvest it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the free market voluntary exchange and transactions would create mechanisms to make it, you know, to make it so that people are comfortable using them. Rothbard was very much in the, he thinks it's fraudulent just across the board, and I've seen that. I thought about, you know, agreeing with him there, but since you can't really regulate it in a free market with rules and diktats, then you have to just let people make their voluntary choices. And I think that, you know, some people would be okay with a certain level of risk and others would not. And some banks would fail and that would be fine. You know, it would be they accept the risk, and worst comes of it, they lose what they put into it. Well, that's what they did. You know, that's what they chose to do.
So given what you know about the context of the movie and the context of the loan as presented in the movie and what you know about the banking situation and the fractional reserve lending that we have, do you sympathize with our two main heroes, or do you denounce their actions?
Well, their mother probably shouldn't have taken the loan, but I think the medical bills prompted her to do it, and again, the government programs that were in place or are in place made the banks feel comfortable in giving this loan, even though she couldn't afford it.
Mm-hmm.
So I can sympathize with their anger about it, but I think resorting to violent means to try to solve their problem was definitely against the NAP and not something that I would support. I can't imagine that, you know, to come up with the $40,000 to pay this loan off, they couldn't find another way of doing it when they knew there was oil on the property. Like, couldn't you imagine, like, okay, you've got this property and you're at risk of losing it, but if you're able to keep it for, you know, $40,000, you'd bring in $50,000 a month for, you know, the next 5, 10, 20 years, whatever. Don't you think that you could find somebody to loan you $40,000
if
you could prove that, you know, hey, I'm going to make $50,000 a month. I'll pay you back $100,000 for your $40,000 today, you know, in 4 months.
I think they would have speculators tripping over themselves, investors tripping over themselves trying to give them money. It's ridiculous, especially since it's absolutely established that they have found oil on the property, and they estimate, and they've already been given some sort of estimate about how much money is going to be coming off of it, and it turns out to be like $50,000 a month. That, you would have zero problems finding anybody to give you money, be it from another bank or any random investor on the street, some family member, anybody. It's really a movie that's fairly unrealistic from that point, but I understand they wanted to tell a story, so this is the solution that the brothers came up with. But it wouldn't be interesting if it was just a one scene movie where two brothers were talking to some potential investor. Hey, we need $40,000. Okay, here you go. I'll write you a check.
Yeah, I mean, they actually go through this lawyer who is apparently aware of this scheme, and he doesn't step up and say, hey, I'll give you guys the $40,000. Why risk your lives and risk, you know, murdering people? Because, you know, even though they claimed that they didn't want to shoot anyone, they initiated the violence, and when people were, like you were saying, you know, they were able to carry firearms themselves so they could defend themselves, when people started shooting back at them, yeah, they shot and killed people.
Yeah.
If I were that lawyer, I would have been like, shit, you guys need like $38,000, $40,000, making you a partner in this thing. I'll give you that right now.
Yeah, I'll give you that right now for 5% of your income, your monthly revenue, or 2%, or whatever. I'll have my money back and then some, or just $100,000 up front. Boom, done. Yeah, it's
so,
fairly ridiculous. Yeah, very short-sighted thing, but I understand they wanted to tell a kind of a heist movie story. So, granted, fairly ridiculous movie at that point. Plot-wise, let's talk about a couple of scenes. One, the scene where the cops are coming in to the restaurant, and he's talking to the waitress, and he wants her tip money. And I think there's some other comments by some other customers at the restaurant about the banks, kind of disparaging comments about the banks. And then I want to talk about, plot-wise, if it made sense for the brothers to split up at the end, and one goes off to basically suicide himself so that the other one can escape, why not just have another car or something like that to escape in? Didn't make a whole lot of sense to me. But if either of those two scenes kind of strike your fancy to talk about, let's talk about them.
Yeah, so let's do the restaurant one first. So while the boys are having lunch, one of them notices that there's a bank across the street, and normally they rob the bank together and they sort of plan it out, and they only rob a certain branch or, I guess, brand of bank.
Company. Yeah.
This one was not.
This was an unplanned one, and it was a different company.
Yeah. So the one, he says he's got to go take a leak or whatever. He goes and robs this other bank just on his own, and the waitress flirts with the other who stays in the restaurant. and he decides to tip her really well, like $200 on a, I don't know, $20 meal.
Yeah.
And then they have to escape out of there because people that are like shooting at them when they're running away, driving away. But yeah, when the cops come, they're like, yeah, we're going to need that $200 tip because it's evidence. And she's like, hell no, you know, you come back with a warrant because this is, you know, going to pay my rent or feed my kids, something along those lines. And, you know, she's totally right. Like, who are they to take this money? I mean, sure, it's probably stolen money, but I don't know, I'm kind of torn on it because, like, how is it evidence to them? Like, it's just $200. Like, what's that going to tell them?
Yeah, I had an issue with that as well. On the one hand, it probably is stolen money. You're right. It almost certainly was. But what would taking it from the waitress solve? What would it? Would you be able to trace that money back to one of the banks that was robbed that you didn't already know were already robbed by these two guys? Earlier in the movie, they admit that they're only taking the loose bills and the till that are basically untraceable, that they're not. So what would taking this waitress's $200 solve? And you know that she wouldn't have gotten it back. That money would just disappear. It's not like once the case is over and solved that she would come in and file some sort of a claim on that money. I doubt it. They were just taking it, and that money would have been gone. So, yeah, I had a big issue with that, and I was all rooting for her to say, nope, you're not taking my money. And the movie ends, I mean, it doesn't resolve that. It ends with Jeff Bridges sending his partner back to collect the money, and they just say good luck to that.
At the very end, when Jeff Bridges goes back into the office after being retired, they say, we talked to the waitress that we took the money from, and she refused to identify this guy.
There you go. The guy she
saw. So I think they do end up taking the money, but that probably cost them the identification of the guy, right? Because she clearly saw who he was, and they allude to saying that she had seen pictures of suspects and refused to identify which one.
Right. So, yeah, that directly led to him getting off then.
Yeah, so maybe a short-sighted move.
Yeah, indeed. Interesting.
So about the one brother sort of sacrificing himself as a diversion so that the other one could escape, I think you're right. You could have just had two different cars and gone in different directions. I mean, he did have to, the one who did get away, he did have to go through a checkpoint. So I think having them both in the same car would have made that a little bit more difficult to get past. But if they had both, you know, had other vehicles and gone separate directions, then they could have, you know, met up later on.
100% agree. Yeah, they did. They were at the time they were driving away from the bank. They were driving in this old beat up, you know, totally shot up pickup, which obviously you couldn't drive that through a checkpoint. But they could have stashed another car where they stashed the one car. And, yeah, driven off in separate directions. And like you said, it would have been easy to spot them. They're looking for two guys at the checkpoint. So, yeah, two individual guys going two different directions. Much more likely that they would escape. I thought it was an unnecessary sacrifice on the part of the one brother. And it ends up, he ends up killing Jeff Bridges' partner with this sniper rifle from atop this hill, which really kind of lights the fire into Jeff Bridges' ass. So even though he's retired, he's still checking up on the Chris Pine character. He still wants to get him. He still blames him for his partner's death. So if they could have just avoided all that, gotten off scot-free. But I guess from a storytelling standpoint, you want some kind of tragedy, some kind of loss, some things to happen. So you got to have things happen in a movie, in a story, or else it's not particularly interesting.
Yeah, and because it's a movie, you sort of need a big shootout at the end. So, I mean, it's their story to tell, and it's in the script, right? And that's one of the things we always say. When something doesn't make a whole lot of sense, we're like, well, it was in the script. So that's what they did.
Yep. The screenwriter had to have, you know, things happen. So even if they're not making the greatest choices, they don't make a whole lot of sense. And that's a problem. You know, as a viewer, you want to understand the choices that people make. You want to be able to put yourself in their position and go, well, I could see myself making that same choice. But when that doesn't happen, when you go, why are they doing that? That's stupid. It takes you out of the movie. And that happens a lot in movies, but I think that's just imperfect script writing, really, because it's not the easiest thing in the world to write a perfect script, because you got to match, you know, a story with perfect motivations and actions, and those things don't coincide, because a lot of, you know, things happen because people make mistakes and leads to interesting situations. But from this, from what they set up in this movie of these super planned series of events by these two brothers, they had planned it out, you know, weeks in advance or more, where they had multiple stolen cars that they were, after each robbery, they'd bury them. So they seemed to be, they knew what they were doing, to all of a sudden at the end go, well, I'm going to go kill myself now. Really, that was the plan? Was that really the plan?
Yeah, they did.
Seems like they could have planned for that not being the plan.
Felt like throughout the movie that the brothers didn't expect to make it out of this alive. That they were wanted to accomplish this one thing, you know, pay off the loan that was due like that Thursday, hell or high water. They had to be there, otherwise it was going to foreclose like the next day.
Right.
And of course the motivation was to provide their kid or his kid the better life. And that felt a little bit contrived, but I think that they sort of built in this expectation that they weren't going to make it through this whole story alive. And he sort of mentions that at the end where he says, you know, to the Jeff Bridges character, well, I have an apartment downtown. Let's finish our discussion there. And he, of course, means, you know, have a shootout, kill each other.
Right.
I don't know. It's like you were saying, you know, it's in the script, and it is hard to write a good script that satisfies all of the necessary elements of the story. It's, you know, back to the beginning of our discussion on this. Like, if you were sitting on $500,000 a year revenue stream, getting a loan from somebody for $30,000 to $40,000 should not be an issue. Should be a non-issue.
Right.
And resorting to violence and robbery to do it, it seems ridiculous. And maybe they were saying that was all the brothers could come up with. Maybe they were that dumb. Like, the one was a criminal, and the other one was not doing a whole lot with his life. You know, he had to take care of the mother while she was dying, and they don't have very much money.
But it's a pretty clever plan to rob the bank that you need to pay back, and they have all these cars, and it's all planned out, and it's a pretty decent plan. You'd think they'd be smart enough to go, maybe there's somebody that's willing to give us a loan for $40,000 to cover this. I mean, it's not like you got a Forrest Gump situation where this is the only thing they could come up with, and it's like a dumb plan. It's not. It's a fairly smart plan. So you got characters acting smart in one area and really, 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 really stupidly in another area, which is okay, I guess. Human beings do that. Human beings are smart in some ways and dumb in other ways. But it seems like a casual bar conversation would solve all their problems. Oh, yeah, there's a bunch of oil in our land. Really? And you got a problem coming up with the money for the mortgage? Well, I know about 20 people who would love to come in on this, even if I don't have $40,000 myself. It just seemed unrealistic from that standpoint.
Do a Kickstarter or a GoFundMe or, you know, take your pick.
Yeah. Any number of solutions that wouldn't need this violent hail of bullets style ending.
Yeah, go to a competing bank and say, hey, look, I've got this contract with Shell. They're going to lease this land for me for $50,000 a month to pump oil off of it. I need $40,000 in the next, you know, however long to pay off the loan. I mean, I get it that the bank that held the loan, if they approached them with that offer, the bank would have been like, well, if we just, you know, drag our feet, we'll end up owning this property.
Right.
You know, make that bank super evil. Like, they definitely tried to demonize that bank even when he went in to go pay the thing.
Right.
They were showing them drag their feet. He's like, oh, you know, this will take till the end of the week. And he's like, no, I'm going to be here to do it. I want to see you do it. I've got all day. I want to see you physically, like, fax this off to the lawyer or whatever.
Yeah, the movie definitely did play off distrust in banks, which is the general feeling, and especially the general feeling after 2008. Distrust of high finance. Like, these people are all greedy, shady characters, and you can't trust them at all.
And there's a lot to be said for that because they do have pretty strong monopoly privilege. I mean, sure, there are lots of banks around, but they're also heavily regulated and structured by the government and the Fed. You know, so there's probably a lot fewer banks than there otherwise would be, and the regulations are such that it's probably... I'm sort of talking about out of my ass here a little bit, but I just think that things in a voluntary society would be far different. They wouldn't be able to get away with treating customers like shit because they would be competing for customers.
Right.
One thing at the end that I thought was interesting when he was having this conversation on the porch with the Jeff Bridges retired Ranger character was Chris Pine said that he was doing it in sort of a non-answering way to Jeff Bridges, like, why'd you do it? He said, well, I've got my two sons, and you got to understand, you know, I grew up poor, and my family before that was poor, and poverty is like a disease. It spreads from generation to generation, and I don't want my boys to catch it, or something along those lines. And I felt that that was a point that was a, you know, Occupy Wall Street type message, like we're against the banks, and poverty is rampant, and there's no way to get out of it, so you have to resort to crime or, you know, putting one over on the banks to get yourself out of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like you're the victim class, and anything you do to fight back against the oppression is justified.
Right, yeah, and it doesn't make a whole lot of sense because, I mean, what was he doing to, like, get himself out of poverty, you know? Robbing banks? Like we said, he could have gotten an investor or a group of investors to get in the money so that he could have got this oil property going. And then what's it going to do to their kids once they have this this income stream coming in, you know? Like, one of the things that they say is from rags to riches in one generation and back to rags in the next. Is like, an entrepreneur will come up with something, you know, pull up by their bootstraps and come up with something that earns a lot of money, and then their kids will inherit this or feel entitled to it and just squander it. And a lot of times, like, people who win lottery are a similar situation, but they do it within their own lifetime, where they'll win the lottery, and then all of a sudden, like, all these people come out of the woodwork, and they're like, oh, yeah, buy me a car, buy me a house, be my entourage, or like, NBA players, or...
Right. Yeah, when you have an income stream that you don't necessarily have to work, you don't see it as work to achieve it. I mean, what incentive is there for you to provide value? You kind of take it as a for-granted situation.
Yeah, people who come into situations like that start acting like government. You know, they don't care how they're spending, what they're spending. They didn't have to earn it. Their service, they're going to get the money anyway, no matter what level of service they provide, until they run out, which they inevitably do. And I think that government will eventually find itself in a situation where it can no longer afford to do a lot of the things it wants to do.
Right. Yeah, you don't see a lot of trust fund babies going out and providing a lot of value in the market. It's more about spending the money that they have. But, it's your money. Do what you want. I'm not against it. It's just an incentive situation.
So the writers for this film certainly did have an axe to grind with the banks.
I can say that, right. And at the end of the day, the whole plot makes no sense because you have some smart people doing a really dumb thing when they could have just solved it with a conversation with some random guy that had 40 grand.
Right, and their lawyers should have had 40 grand, no problem.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, any of those people, any number of people could have solved this problem without violence, but then it wouldn't have been the same movie that the storyteller wanted to tell. So overall, I thought it was pretty good. I liked the ending. I thought it was well made, other than the quibble of the plot points that we're talking about. I mean, that's a pretty major flaw in that it could be solved with a casual conversation with a random person. But it is what it is. I thought it was fairly well made, except for those issues.
Yeah, I agree.
Good performances. I thought Jeff Bridges was good.
Yeah, I'm glad you suggested it. I think it was an entertaining movie. I may watch it again and see if I see anything else in it. Not that we're going to do a show on it again, because I feel like we've probably talked enough about it. But I will post a bunch of things down at the below, so that hour-and-a-half lecture by Murray on banking, and then also a link to the Tom Woods book called Meltdown, which is talking about the housing bubble and the 2008 financial crisis, and basically making a case for where the blame should actually lie, not to the banks themselves, but to a lot of government programs that kind of grease the skids for that whole scenario to play out.
Exactly.
So what do you say?
And it is frustrating when you feel like the richest among us are getting bailed out and other people don't get bailed out. I saw the bailout as, a large bank robbery of the theft of the money of the American people. I think if you go out and you make risky loans, even if it is backed by government or whatever, I mean, it's tough because government provides incentives for them to do that. But it's still incredibly risky behavior. And then you fail. Well, you kind of made your own bed. You shouldn't have to lie in it. And in a free market situation, that's what would happen. Those banks would have failed. And that's a good thing.
Yeah, sometimes I feel the argument that they pumped all this money into the system to prop it up, and it bought maybe some time. Like, I know in 2008, I wasn't full libertarian, studying Rothbard and whatnot, and now I have, and I've been able to position my family, in a house, and we're sort of out of the main path of the city and all that. So I've had time to or get in a better position being aware of what I am? So I don't know.
Good deal, man.
I mean, that's a very pragmatic situation. I of course prefer that.
I'm sure you'll be able to fix it all in editing, but you've been quiet for the past like half hour.
Oh, well, yeah, sorry, I was adjusting my...
Yeah, now you're quiet again. Input.
There we go.
Are you doing something differently? Yeah, you're slightly louder.
I've got an adjustment on my mic that I've been playing with. I turned it way down, like, to silent, because I was about to sneeze, and then I turned it back up probably a little bit too high.
Okay. I'm sure you'll be able to normalize it all in editing. It's fine.
Yeah, and I'll even leave this bit in, because it's, you know, it's instructional for anyone who's thinking of doing a podcast. Make sure your inputs are leveled the way they need to be, and then in post, do some normalization to make it all even out.
Right. Overall,
so
I recommend this movie, though.
Up, Robert?
Yep. Finish it up. Wrap it. It was good. I liked it. It was enjoyable. Not a perfect movie by any means. You go in, suspend your disbelief, and go, this is the best plan these two guys could come up with. And they're smart enough to do that, but not smart enough to have a conversation about money with anybody else in the movie. Fine. Good. Fairly fun plot. Moves along. Decent pace. It might be a little slow in the beginning for some people, I thought, or at least after the bank robberies happened, and then it kind of meanders a bit. But overall, good. Good performances. Enjoyable.
Yeah, I agree. And I enjoyed watching the movie. I'd probably watch it again. But yeah, plenty of holes in it, but it gave us at least some banking things to talk about and some actual intelligent folks that we can refer you to for more information.
Dread.
So thank you for coming on the show again, Robert. Appreciate
yeah,
it. So folks, that's it for this one, Hell or High Water. We are the Reed Rothbard Podcast. We run ReedRothbard.com, books, lectures, articles, this podcast. Click on one of those Amazon Prime links on our site, and you can try Amazon Prime free for 30 days. You can watch movies, listen to music, get 2 days shipping on anything you purchase on Amazon. Or if you already are a Prime member, go ahead and make some purchases after clicking on one of those links, and we'll get a small commission. We appreciate it. We appreciate you. And good night, folks. Thank you very much.
You sexy, sexy bitches. Chipmunks. C-H-I-P-M-U-N-K. We're the chipmunks. Guaranteed to brighten your day. Do-do. Do-do-do-do. Do-do. Do-do-do-do.